Hi, everyone. I feel like this is a small enough group that that I'm going to ask you some questions, actually. First of all, my name is Amanda Hedon-Murphy, and I'm the gallery director here in Hamiltonian. Welcome. So, you're a small group this evening, but that's a nice thing. I'm totally happy with this. I'm curious about maybe some questions that you might have or something that you thought you'd like to learn from the artist tonight, if I could just get you to mull that for a sec. It's kind of nice when the artists are here, they're like, huh, this is what people want to know. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts? Like, why are you here? For real. Because she made you. Okay. That's not what I was looking for. Really.
There's a question already up on the board.
How did I get here? Well, see, yes. So,
helping you out. Throwing you a bone.
When you come to an artist talk, what is something that you're hoping to learn?
The process.
Cool. Okay. We'll definitely get to that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Development of ideas.
Nice. All right. Anything else? Those are both like pretty good artist talk basics right there. So that's great. So tonight we are going to get to both of those. We're actually going to start with Kyle, and then we'll go into Nancy. And what we'll do is we'll have Kyle give a presentation and overview of what he's been doing and has done to lead him to this place. And then we'll follow up with Nancy. The two of them will actually get to ask each other some questions because really, when we put together these shows, sometimes the artists have met each other in advance and oftentimes they haven't. So this is kind of the equivalent of getting to know each other a little bit better too. And I do think that there will be lots of overlap, I'm sure, between how you handle your practices. And then after that, we'll open it up to the audience. So I anticipate it'll be about 20 to 25 minutes per artist, and then we hand the floor over to you. Just really quickly, programmatically, we have a lot of things going on here. Can I see a show of hands really quick? How many of you are artists in your own right? Awesome. Okay, great. So we're going to be having a workshop, and Nancy and Kim are actually, if you could raise your hand. Nancy, the artist who's giving the talk tonight, and Kim Urin, who's also an artist, who's going to be leading a workshop on how to document your own artwork. And if you are ever looking to apply to any type of residency or program such as this one, it's a really good thing to know how to do. Also, if you would like to join us, on May 11th, we're going to have our second game night. So all of the board games that you see on the wall here are totally playable. And we had an event here earlier in the month where everybody got together and played the games. The only one we didn't get to play was Settlers of Catan DC version. So you get to gentrify DC according to the rules of Settlers of Catan. So that's happening on May 11th at 7 p.m. if you'd like to come back, and it's a lot of fun. All right, so we'll go ahead and get started. I'm going to read both of your bios, and then I'll hand it off to you, Kyle. All right. Nancy Daly is a DC-based artist whose videos, installations, and sculptures examine how the development of the online social world affects identity and social behavior. She holds an MFA in Photographic and Electronic Media from the Maryland Institute College of Art and a BFA in Graphic Design from James Madison University. Daly has exhibited in numerous solo and group shows, including Click Here at Arlington Art Center in 2017, Recombinant Fellows RA, and Save As, which are both at Hamiltonian Gallery. She lives and works in Washington, D.C. Kyle Bauer moved to Baltimore after earning his MFA from Louisiana State University in 2011. Since 2012, he's been the conservation technician of prints, drawings, and photographs at the Baltimore Museum of Art. Bauer was a 2014 Sondheim Artscape Prize finalist, a 2015 Maryland State Arts Council Individual Artist Grant Award recipient, and a finalist for the 2015 Miami University Young Sculptors Competition for the William and Dorothy Yeh Award. Recent exhibitions include Cardinal at the Delaware Contemporary Art Museum in Wilmington, Delaware, the Clay National, the Clay Studio National in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Fairway at Flashpoint Gallery. He's exhibited at the Walters Art Museum, Vox Populi, Flashpoint, Randall Scott Projects, McDaniel College, Arlington Art Center, School 33, and Maryland Art Place. Welcome to the book.
Thank you very much, Amanda. And so the first question that I have here is, well, how did I get here? And that's two sides to it. An important part of my process and practice is focused around navigation of symbols, signs, objects. I grew up in the Midwest, specifically Southern Illinois, on a very, very flat plain. So the horizon was very, very impressive. And my family lived in Chicago. We spent a lot of time in the back of a 1985 Chevrolet Suburban, driving across the prairie in Illinois. Very, very flat. But one of the things that I have always kind of mined from my personal history was, as we traveled, there were all these radio antennas that would rise out from the cornfields. And, you know, when you drive by them, they stick up out of the sky, or stick up out of the ground in the sky. And as you move around them, they kind of always sit still, and you kind of, I guess, orbit would be a good way to put it. So this is an introduction for you folks that don't know me, kind of what has been going on in my art practice since graduating and moving to Baltimore for an artist in residency position at Baltimore Clay Works post MFA. So skipped a couple years ahead to the first slide here. This was my first solo show out of graduate school at the Pine Box Art Center, which unfortunately now is closed, but this was a continuation of ideas that weren't able to kind of come out while in graduate school for various reasons. You know, if anyone's ever, I mean, anyone that's in academia can understand there's a lot of different pressures that put you in there. So, you know, wanted to start off with a show with this image, and then jumping ahead to a series of work that really started the beginning of where I am now. This piece, as you can see, is titled A Trophy for Brian. It comes from the kind of the blending of a narrative, Brian being my father, and then kind of putting together the narrative with the sculptural object, and as you see it. And then you'll see in a couple slides from here kind of how I lay out my installations, in that they're either set up in navigable grids so that you, the viewer, come into them and navigate around them, through them, you know, over them. We're still kind of discussing that process of inviting the viewer to navigate over them. This was a very interesting time, because at the same time that I had Arlington Art Center, I was awarded finalist at the Sondheim Artscape Prize in Baltimore. So there was a massive output of ideas. And as you can tell in my work, I'm very formal. Kind of how I start my process is I work and focus first in a sketchbook, really, really quick. Kind of hashing out ideas, maybe putting some very simple shapes together, some ideas together, and then take that and expand on that idea into my studio. And I have a lot of little objects that I've either cast from ceramic or collected that are plastic, plaster, and do a series of drawings, I call them drawings, but they're really 3D arrangements, and take quick mental notes, do sketches from them, take pictures with the iPhone. I mean, having a phone to do, you know, sit there for 20 minutes and say, or 30 minutes, every 5 minutes I'm going to change this over, you know, and kind of have that exercise to not be sold on that first execution really has allowed me to investigate, you know, or repeating shapes or coming, you know, coming to certain assemblages. You know, this is another one. This piece is titled NOLA. NOLA is an abbreviation for New Orleans, Louisiana. And at this time, you know, I had been away from Southeast Louisiana for 3 years, give or take, maybe 2.5. And one thing I really loved about the architecture, and architecture is a very influential element to my work, is that, you know, it's a very simple shotgun home. It's very modest, but the front, the facade, has such an over-the-top presence. It can be seen as you come down the road, and it's very much the calling card to that person's home. But the other five or six sides are just standard shingles and are of a very plain color. And one thing I keyed on were the corbels. I really enjoyed kind of the freedom that came from an individual's kind of style with all the ornate detail and how it functioned two ways. It was both pretty, but it also supported the eaves and the porch front. So this was an homage to that. And then kind of, you know, taking another idea and then slamming it together with a radio antenna and thinking how the lights work, and then put that together. And here's the installation that was at Arlington. A couple pieces obviously did make the cut. So, but to kind of focus on the conceptual nature or the kind of the fuel behind what I'm interested in is not only navigation, but how formally these works are presented to you, the viewers, through balance, tension, and control, and kind of how that sits with you, the viewer, when you come into the gallery. And is it inviting? Does it repel you? And really kind of honing in on those elements in my own studio and kind of how I react to them, in hopes that when I bring that from my studio to the gallery, you are encouraged to interact with this piece. You know, an interaction isn't something that you pick it up and move it. It's more so it lures you in, it attracts you in, and it bites you in, and then you navigate around this object. So this was this spring solo was a direct investigation into how a layout will encourage a navigation, because before they were very much kind of ad hoc. I would just play with them and see how they went together. And this is based off a Hippodamean grid, which is back from ancient Greece, and that was the first formal city grid plan. And it was designed for many reasons, but it was for even parcel of land, even division of land, but also for the movement of people. And that's something, as someone that's very interested in navigation and how we move from point A to point B, and just being very cognizant on a macro level of how we move on roads and bridges and skies and waterways, but also on a micro level of how we do it in an architectural, well, like a domestic setting, like in our homes. So taking those two ideas and sticking them right next to each other to come up with an arrangement. This piece was for the Sondheim show at the Walters, and when this was created, what was really kind of eating in my eating at the tips of my fingers, I would describe it, would be how do I elicit tension? How do I put tension out there so that it looks as if where's the on button? And I'm a material. I would describe myself as a material nerd. I love certain materials, but these materials have to have a personal history with me. My families, they flip homes, and that's what I did growing up. I had a hammer, and I was underneath a foundation at the age of six. You know, kind of getting those skills and getting those familiarity with these materials, when I was searching for what to make my work out of, I just kept going back to plywoods, plaster. I used slipcast ceramic, fiberglass, latex house paint, and incorporating not only the materials but a lot of the techniques into the fabrication of the sculptures. And this study, the name composition, really started in the sketchbook. And I'm not always the best with titles. More so lately, I've really tried to draw out kind of the narrative and the story that I develop in my head, and use the title to be able to relate to the viewer in some way or clue into a narrative that's behind it. And the composition series, there's multiple in that series, and it really starts out in the sketchbook, and it goes with the number of parts and pieces or sides. So you can see 4-in-1, it's one fiberglass pole, one ceramic ball, and then four sides to it. Two are perforated, two are solid. Move over to Tropical Bomb Pop. Thanks, John. For any of you that were here for New Now, this piece stood right there. This piece was inspired twofold. The Tropical Bomb Pop is from a memory of mine growing up and visiting Chicago and seeing the little guys pushing the not only the tamale carts but the ice cream carts, and they would sell these bomb pops. They called them Freedom Pops. They had all these, you know, different names, and they had different flavors, and it just always was a very arresting picture of a ice cream with flame shooting out the back of it on the side of this cart that this guy was pushing, playing, you know, mariachi music, and you know, in a muddy area with the, you know, Sears Tower right up over to your left, and it was just, it's really, it doesn't exist anymore. It's called Maxwell Street. Look it up. It's pretty interesting. And then, Thanks John is I had a show at 39th Street, and John Paradiso helped me set up, and he's the gallery director. He was in New York, and he kept shooting pictures a couple weeks later of all the fiberglass rods around New York, and saying, you're here, you're here, you're here, you're here, and so I had to, and this second piece on the left with the tall fiberglass rod was a similar idea that he had sent me a picture to. So, kind of going further into that narrative, diving into, you know, connecting the two parts that you see there, and the repetition of the lines, you know, you see in the back piece. There's Thanks John again. The repetition comes from another personal history of mine. I grew up around a reservoir, and that was controlled by Army Corps of Engineers, and they did a whole series of planting of mostly pine trees, and they would treat them like corn. And then, you know, growing up in the Midwest, there's a lot of corn, soybeans. You get to the point where you're driving, and you look out the window, and the chatter between whatever is growing or whatever has been tilled, it creates a sense of motion, and almost like a not a velodrome, a zoetrope, and that it rattles, and it's like, if you're just staring at it long enough and you kind of let your eyes relax, you can't be driving, obviously, but you must be riding. You stare at it, and it moves forward or it moves backward. So there's that constant repetition that I'm always attracted to, and it's either in through use of stripes, repeating motifs, or just simply arranging these fiberglass rods into a series that look like trees, corn, soybeans, a freshly disked field. And that's from the installation. And then this was from my show at Flashpoint, and Memphis Billboard is one of two things, and both a friend of mine turned me on to the Memphis School of Design, and it was funny because the Memphis School of Design is from a bunch of Italian designers. It has nothing to do with Memphis, Tennessee. It was just a name that they chose out of blue, and that's what they liked, and it was something that was really funny, and I really enjoyed how colorful and almost how a three-dimensional form became flat through the construction, and that as you turn it, it became flat and three-dimensional, flat and three-dimensional. And this piece actually rests against the wall, and this was also a break and an interest into my work that I started really looking at, and maybe was subconsciously influenced by a dear friend of mine, Amy Bloom-Creesh, who uses very frilly things as well, but I started looking at my history, and I grew up hunting and fishing. So I started pulling out all the stuff from my collections of stuff in my boxes because I moved, and I started really looking at my history and kind of bringing that, and that those streamers are direct reference to teasers. So things that would be drugged behind a boat and provide a sort of lure for the predator or the fish to attack to. So shiny looks like a wounded fish or looks like wounded prey, then they would attack on it. So, you know, something I was interested in is kind of playing on that idea in how to get your attention through a shiny little object about the corner of your eye. So this is a trail kind of going into it. This Centralia Orphan Little Boots is a piece that goes, again, the narrative is that the Centralia Orphans, it's actually a town near where I grew up, and that was the name of their basketball team. And we used to go to their holiday tournament. It was called the Orphans Holiday Tournament. And there was this one road that had this special water tower, and I just, in, you know, it and it was so funny because it was this striped color, it was this pattern, but the bottom always had a different color on it, and you know, if it's a almost exact replica, subconsciously wasn't thinking about it, but it came out that way. Southern Sun, this is you know, both an homage to kind of that Southern sensibility of looking really good but knowing how to party. They look good and they get down, and really liked how it arranged, and it could be put on a ceiling, put on a floor, but it caused you, the viewer, to move around it. And this is AAM. This piece is my biggest piece to date. It's almost 8 feet tall, and it really, with the tapering legs, with its physical presence, it really is like a sentinel in a room. You know, you come to it, you move around it. It's the lighthouse, it's the radio tower. You know, it is the thing that you go towards, and then you can see kind of how this exhibition was laid out at Flashpoint. And then move into there's a concurrent show that's running with Existential Rec Room, and that is Cardinal, and that's currently up at Delaware Contemporary Museum in Wilmington. And these are some new pieces that I've been working on. And as you guys maybe have noticed, there's this thread that there was this covering up everything, of concealing all the materials, and then there's this slow transition to opening and exposing and being honest about the materials. And that was something that, you know, I, as an artist, you always are looking into yourself and kind of figuring out, well, what's making you tick? And there was something about the calling card of always being crisp, clean, and concealed. And it was something both conceptually but also process, and that I really wanted to challenge myself, because the materials that I use have, you know, I have a personal history with, but I'm also interested in kind of accentuating what they're made of. And let me see those two. And then some of the stories, Red Touches Black, Friend of Jack, that's actually a saying that comes from, if you come across a snake, corn snake, or a, what is it? It is a corn snake, or it is a
coral snake.
Coral, thank you. Thank you very much. And corn snakes look very similar. And that's the whole deal about red touching black, Friend of Jack. Red touches yellow, you're a dead fellow. So that was, I really, kind of going back to those lessons learned in scouts, hunter safety courses, fishing, you know, fishing adventures, kind of bringing that into my work. And then here's a pano shot of the current show. And so there's, you know, there's what's really important about, you know, kind of important in making my work is that, you know, I maintain these three formal ideas or conceptual presentations of balance, tension, and control. They can be interpreted both in the 20-minute mark. They can be both presented in a physical presence, like tension or balance, or control, you know, feeling that they're sitting there very stagnant, but also in a conceptual or what I would say a mental kind of state, in that physical tension, that physical presence that you all know. You know when you walk into a room and it's a little weird. So those elements, as you can see in the current work that I showed you here, with also the work that's behind us, in that, you know, there's material, but all these pieces in some way, shape, or form have a sense of balance, tension, and control.
Let's go ahead and switch into the next thing. If you have questions for Kyle, hold on to them, and then we'll ask the other round.
My work is all the work that's on the walls in here right now. And the show with us both is called Existential Rec Room, but I like to refer to this series, my series of work, it's called One Must Consider Them Happy. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit, and I'll explain what that means. This is, like, I literally just did this live for Kim's class, but... yeah. So this is basically to show you, like, what some of my previous work has looked like. There's, like, a lot of white. I'm talking about social media and the internet and the mechanics of how the online social world is affecting our behavior, and I'm trying to get you to look at these systems and, like, think about how you navigate through them. So this is sort of like, this series is sort of a next step in that, but the difference is that, well, there's like a lot more color, as you can see, but also it's a lot more personal to me. In this previous work, I'm using other people's posts on social media. For this work, it's like all about me and the systems that I'm trapped in. The title of the show, or the title of the series, One Must Consider Them Happy, is a reference to the last line in Albert Camus' 1942 philosophical essay about the myth of Sisyphus. And in that essay, he's talking about, like, the absurd and how, like, there's this eternal search for meaning, and we can never find the true meaning of things because there's too much information and there's just, like, so many things that are keeping it. We will never be able to get to it. So in that essay, Camus is, like, likening that to the myth of Sisyphus. He basically defied the gods. I'm, like, glossing over the myth of Sisyphus. But he defied the gods. He, like, put death in chains so that, like, no one could die. And then death got out, and then eventually Sisyphus died, and then the gods were like, how could you do this? We're going to punish you for all eternity. You're going to push this boulder up a hill. So Camus is, like, likening that to this idea of the absurd and how we can never truly, like, understand, even though we keep trying to. And in that essay, he's also talking about, like, the different ways, he's working through the different ways to escape the absurd and, like, what Sisyphus might have been thinking, and, like, why not, again, glossing over it, but, like, why not just kill yourself, because you can never get out of this. So he ends, basically, that you have to imagine that Sisyphus was happy, and that's why he was happy in doing the work. It wasn't about, like, getting to some end point. He's happy in that. So it's important for you to remember that, like, positive note, because that's how, like, for the whole show, that's sort of how I'm framing things, is that, like, it's the thing that's common among all of these games is you can't win them, but it's fun to play. And so this is my parents' game closet. And so a lot of this work, all of this work comes from the fact that, like, growing up, my family played a lot of games, still play a lot of games with my family. And I think of games as, like, a way of creating community and bonding. And so I'm getting you to try to interact with these things in a communal way. And that's also why it's important to me that, like, all of these games, there's playable versions, there was a game night, there's going to be another game night. It's important to me that, like, you are able to play these and put yourself in the position of playing all of them. But it's also important to me that you are looking them divorced of being able to play them, and they're sort of like maps that you have to figure out. So you're like, when they're on the wall, to me, it's about, like, looking at the underlying system and trying to puzzle that out. And then when you're playing them, it's about, you know, putting you in that position. Yeah, so the first one, the one that I started with first is right here and there. It's called Sorry Not Sorry, The Game of Promotion in Higher Education. This is the one I started with, and it's the most upsetting to me, I guess. But I get, so the background information on this and my personal background is that, like, I teach, I'm an adjunct. Lots of your teachers are adjuncts. And so, like, I teach at two different schools. I teach four classes. Like, a full-time course load is considered three classes. So this is, like, a very personal thing to me that I'm working through. But anyway, in Sorry Not Sorry, The Game of Promotion in Higher Education, the board is structured in such a way that's sort of meant to reflect the current statistics of higher education. And then when you play, I'm sort of putting you in the position of somebody who's working through that system. This slide just says feelings. That's what I put in my note. I have a lot of feelings. Okay, so here's some charts. So this first chart is, it's a little bit old, but it's basically just to show that, I don't know if you can read it there, but in 1969, 78.3% of jobs were tenure track positions. Not necessarily people that had tenure, but, like, were eligible for tenure. And only 21.7% were non-tenure track. So that includes, like, full-time, non-tenure track, or adjuncts, or grad students. And as you can see, by 2009, 66% shifted to not eligible for tenure. This is just, like, another chart showing that. Like, the breakdown as of 2014, so 22% were full-time tenure track. And then all three of these are, like, the ones that aren't. So anyway, and then in this one you can see that, like, over time, the positions available have decreased substantially. So the structure of the board itself, if you were to just look at the board and not play, you would eventually see, I'm going to save some time and just tell you, that the only ones that you could actually win, the only players that could actually win on this board are the three that are, like, different shades of yellow. And then the ones that are the warmer colors are tenure or full-time eligible, so the players can come up into here. And then the ones that are the cooler colors, you can't even get into the full-time eligible track. So you're just, if you're playing in this system, you're just going around in circles, and it's so much fun, but you can never win. And I think, like, the with this one, the other thing that I, the reason that I wanted to, like, base it on these statistics, so, like, only about 30% of the people that are playing can actually get to tenure, is that the board is divorced from the individual person. So I think that when you're thinking about the adjunct situation, there's a tendency to be like, well, maybe this person doesn't want to be full-time, or like maybe they work, like maybe they do this other job and like this is just on the side, or like, and so I'm trying to get you to like look in just the board and see like most of the time it's not that. And then the more personal side of this comes in through the cards. So there's a deck of 52 cards, and the way that you play is that as you pick up a card and it tells you what to do. So you're either moving the number of spaces, or you end up with like the sorry, not sorry card, and that causes you to go all the way back to the beginning. And so all of the information written on the cards is like specific situations that have happened to me personally or people that I know. Or there's a couple that are like, you know, like you get into a car accident and have to like not teach for a semester so that you can actually pay your medical bills. Like that hasn't happened to me, but like it could happen. So anyway, it has stuff like you're not aggressive enough when trying to get a class, move forward zero spaces, or you're too aggressive when trying to get a class, move forward zero spaces. So this is not super fun to play, but anyway. So then that leads me to the next one, and that's the one that's up there. It's the chutes and ladders for the gig economy. So I drove Uber for a little bit. And so, again, a lot of these, like, they're personal to me, but they're also, like, just things that happen with the gig economy. So in case you're not familiar, the gig economy is basically, like, trying to... like, all of those things like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, where you're, like, trying to put together a living wage through a series of gigs, or just get some extra money or whatever. So, like, TaskRabbit is another one. And then just, like, a personal side note, Chutes and Ladders was the only game that I was allowed to play with my grandmother because she was... insanely competitive. But Chutes and Ladders is based purely on chance. There's no skill to it. You just roll the dice and you go through, and so you can only get so competitive. Chutes and Ladders is based on a game from India that I don't know the name of, but eventually the British got it and they called it Snakes and Ladders. And the Indian game was based on the idea of karma or destiny. It's like not skill. So the snakes were vices. And so if you land at the, like if you're moving through the board and you land at the top of a snake that's like represented by some vice, you're like shot back to the end. And then if you land on the bottom of a ladder, that's supposed to be a virtue. You get to shoot up to the top. And then there were less ladders than there were snakes because it's harder to live a virtuous life. So Chutes and Ladders was then adopted by the British, and then Milton Bradley took it to the US and turned it into this like game of morality. So if you're not familiar, like in this one, there's like things that the kid's doing that results in something positive, like mowing the lawn, you get to go to the fair. but stealing cookies, you get stars around your head. I don't know. So I'm sort of in this equating... I'm sort of equating, like, working in the gig economy to... It's sort of a game of chance. And so the ones I'm, like, pulling out here are specific to Uber. But so, like, in this one... somebody calls you, and it's hard to see here, but they're calling you from PJ drinks a lot bar or something. And so you pick up somebody from there and you like think it's great, and then they end up throwing up in your car. And so then you lose out on Monday because you can't drive for the rest of the night, and it's very sad. In this one, somebody's picking you up from an unknown location, and you take them, and it turns out that they're like, they need to be driven to a farm in the middle of nowhere, and then there's no one else for miles. So then you like waste a ton of gas money, like driving to the, like 40 minutes away to pick somebody up. So they're all sort of things that are like, you know, you can make money in the gig economy, and people do, but there's also like a lot of things that have, there's a lot left up to chance. So I'm sort of just getting you to think about that. And then in this one, you can't win. In Sorry Not Sorry, like three people could win. In this one, it ends with somebody giving you a 1-star rating and writing, I guess the service was fine, but I'm just having a bad day, so there's no way I'm going to give this person a good rating. And then you end up back at 87, and you can never win. You just keep going on and on. Fun fact, back at square one, is it derives from Chutes and Ladders, that phrase.
Really?
Yes.
Very
yeah. That's from Wikipedia. The next one is Life. So this is the original, and this is my version. And so this is the game of like your social media life. In this one, I tried to keep the design of the board like very, very close to the original. When you get up close to it, you can see there's like little green lines that are supposed to like mimic a circuit board. So sort of like hint at this technological world, but the idea behind that and like not changing the name to like the game of social media life is just to point to the fact that these things, like, they're not separate, our lives aren't separate. And so then in this one, you spin the dial and then you move around the board. That's how life works. And at each of the spots, there's like a different thing can happen to you. So you go online to check the weather and then get distracted by the fish with human teeth. Or a meme you created becomes a symbol for hate speech and then you lose money. Because that happened. Not to me. And then there's one, my favorite is you lose money if you end up being like 2010 Justin Bieber, but then you lose even more money if you become 2015 Justin Bieber. Let life go. And then, so this one also has like a lot of different illustrations. This right here is an emoji. This right here is an emoji Rickroll. So I've like hidden a lot of little things in there. And then the way that life works is that each person gets three cards as well. So you get a career card. So there's the app developer, the parent, the grandparent with dial-up, the podcaster, the internet celebrity, the online dater, the troll, a corporation, or a teenager. And then depending on what you land on, different people get the money. So if you land on this one, the teenager gets the money that you lose, so, or the followers that you lose. So you're too old to understand why the hot new app is cool, you lose half of your followers to the teenager, who would obviously know why the hot new app was cool. And then you pick a card that has your, instead of the houses that are in life, you get a device, so flip phone versus iPhone. More of a benefit. And then this is how many followers you get each time somebody new follows you. And then the thing with life is that you get to the very end and then you lose all of your followers and the app that you were basing your social media life around, like they get sold or destroyed or whatever, and you have to start all over again. So you just keep playing continuously, and it's so much fun. This is the electoral risk, the electoral college risk. And so in the game of Risk, basically, the original game of Risk, what you're doing is you have armies and you're rolling dice to try to beat other people in adjacent countries, and then you're taking over the countries. So it's this, like, battle situation. And I had the idea, like, about a year ago to do an electoral college Risk, but then, like, about a year ago, I was like, that doesn't make any sense. People, like, base elections on values. And so I decided not to do it, and then the election happened, and then I was like, it is kind of like a war. I am going to do this. So the idea behind this one is basically just getting you, or it was a way to get me to, like, think like somebody running a campaign, and you're working through that. So the setup that's on there now would be, like, at the start of a game, and there it would be, like, the three players, and that was the setup. There is basically what 538 thought the election results would be. So you're starting at, like, what they thought they would be, and then you're conquering and you're picking up electoral votes, and that's about it. And then the last one is the Settlers of DC, and this is based on Settlers of Catan. If you haven't played that before, basically each one of these hexagons is a different resource, and you're rolling dice to collect resources, and then you're building up settlements and roads on these resources. And so in this one, I've basically, each one of the hexagons is a different, like, area of DC, and you're building up, you're collecting resources off of these areas of DC, and you're building up. So you're gentrifying it, basically. So there's Target, each person's a different corporation. Your Target or Starbucks or McDonald's or just generalized construction or Chipotle. The pink ones are millennials just taking over the place. Oh, yeah. And then the last thing is in the back of the room on the blue is a series of cards called Visual Literacy. And these are based on, like, growing up, I mean, they're based on these things called rebuses. They're, like, word puzzles. But growing up, my parents have this thing in their house that is basically a bunch of these word puzzles. And so when you walk into their house, people stop, and they're very old. And so, like, a lot of them, we have no idea what they mean because they're, like, old jokes and old references. And so with these, I'm sort of updating that. So visual literacy is the ability to interpret and make meaning out of, like, images over words. That's sort of what you're doing here. And the idea, for me, this is basically, like, a trivia game that, like, prioritizes visual literacy over, like, the literacy of written word. I sort of think about, like, emojis and how Instagram has become so popular as sort of, like, a form of language rather than, like, it's not just, like, look at what I ate for breakfast. It's a way of communicating. And so it prioritizes people that, like, know a lot about, you know, like, put visuals together and, like, know a lot about pop culture. A lot of these are very pop culture based. And you're not really, you don't really have to know a lot about the thing that it's talking about. You just need to be able to identify the visuals. So does anyone know what this one is?
Moby Dick.
Yes, it's Moby Dick. But you, like, don't have to know anything about Moby Dick to get it, which is sort of the point. Does anyone know what this one might be? Young people. I tried to make these not based on like only people that are my age could get it. Do any young people? What do you think?
Frank Ocean.
Yeah, what do you think? It's a song. What song do you think it is?
I think
it's
Frank
Ocean. Yeah. That's it. Young people. Yeah. Old people can't get it. I never would have recognized that as Frank Ocean. I knew of Frank Ocean, but had to Google him to make this. What about this one?
This is for Debbie Reynolds.
Yeah, Debbie Reynolds. Yeah. Okay, so so the idea is that you're like with all of these is that you're playing them and you're having fun playing them, but it's like a little bit bleak. But you know, all of these, they're a little bit bleak. But they're fun to play. Not that like it's fun to play things that have like large consequences on people's lives, but you know. I'm done.
There's very much kind of a cynicism that is an underlying feeling that I get from the work. And do you feel that the cynicism is that, you know, we, for the most part, were told or instructed that if we do this, 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 and this, and we do it the right way, things will happen. And well, unbeknownst to factors of us, of, you know, crooks and thieves and scandals and politics and this, that, and the other thing. It's very much left kind of like a bankrupt system that we're left to navigate. I mean, is that where, you know, where this work kind of gets started or where your kind of concept grows out of?
I guess. I think for me it's less about like I was promised this and it didn't work out, and more just like getting you to, like, I want people to think about how these systems have changed. So like, you know, when you play the original Life or like the original Chutes and Ladders, you're like working through these, you know, like, in life, you're, like, working through checkpoints, like, you go to college and all that sort of thing. And so, like, I'm not necessarily saying, like, that is all dead and I'm so sad about it. I'm more trying to get you to just think about how they've changed. And, like, if you don't acknowledge how something works, then you can't make it better. I feel like it may come off as very cynical and like joke about it, but like it's more of like, let's look at these things so that we can move past them.
Yeah, become aware of the situation and how it's evolved, but be cognizant to critique it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Do we just go back and forth between?
I mean, I don't know if you have a question for Kyle.
Yeah, I have a question for Kyle. In seeing you like install this, like it felt like you were like so laid back about the idea that somebody could bump into them and they could crash over, and then like hearing you talk about it, like I understand how they're constructed and it's interesting to me that, like, you're sort of, like, they're supposed to look, they're sort of, like, lure you around. And so there's this, like, play between, like, getting lured to something that, like, you don't want to bump into. Like, how do you... Do you feel that at all? Or, like, that you're playing with, like, that's where I feel the tension.
Yeah.
It's like you're trying to get me to get close to it, but I'm afraid if I get too close to it, I will destroy everything.
Yeah, it's that you know, kind of playing with your emotions, playing with your sense of comfort. And I think that it goes with almost, I think it's based on my interests and instincts and kind of how we react to situations. And you know, thinking of how, you know, when you see something when you're 6 years old as opposed to seeing something when you're 12 years old and then seeing something when you're 32 years old, and how your views change through, you know, oh, this is what I thought it was, but it's really not that. And there's a word I focus on in a lot, and I maybe mentioned it, I might not have, is facade. Facade has a dual meaning. It's not only an architectural term for the front of a building, but it's a false front. And that false front is really a good starting point in how I not only put this work together, but how I approach it, in that, you know, like a lure, or it lures you in, you know, it's providing you with you know, is it really going to happen? Is it not going to happen? And then that puts that physical tension in the world and in the space. It's really funny that you said I'm so laid back. I don't picture myself as laid back.
I was surprised how laid back.
Yeah, I mean, my wife can attest to it. I'm pretty intense. And I don't know if you can't tell, but I mean, everything is pretty polished. It has to be precise. It's clean, and that just goes back to you know, maybe some subconscious things I'm attracted to. I've always loved design. I've always been very attracted to design, especially Scandinavian designs. You know, not just IKEA, but the real stuff. But having a background in ceramics, is really interesting, because it's such a material that, I don't know, it has, I love it and I hate it. And it's a pain in the ass, and it's so frustrating, but it's so rewarding. And it's so cool, it's hot right now. But, I mean, when I moved to Baltimore, everyone's like, oh, you're a resident Baltimore player, so you use clay. I'm like, I didn't commit sin, I just like material, you know? And I've had multiple people ask me, well, why do you use clay? Because I like it, I know what to do with it.
I think it adds to the tension in these pieces, too. Like, yeah. Once you know, feel like you could shatter everything. Like,
yeah, and it's something, you know, as a material, I think it, you know, and it maybe in a weird way we're connected in this, and it's like thinking of your life. And like, if you make a decision, whatever decision that might be, go to school, not go to school, support this election, or not, buy a house in this neighborhood, don't buy it in this neighborhood. I mean, it could completely make or break you. And there is some sort of individual critique that, you know, I attach in my own work, but I definitely see in your work in that it's a strength, in that you have to physically put yourself into it to activate it. And then you become aware of where you're at, consciously or subconsciously, or, you know, immediately, or maybe you're walking down the street and then it's just like a lightning bolt hits you and you're just like, and then you're jotting down your notebook or something like that. So, yeah, when Amanda proposed us getting together and then the board games, it was really intriguing, because I was, you know, I was really interested in kind of seeing where
where you were going to go with these, so.
Any questions?
In the back.
Sorry, open to questions now?
Yeah,
go for
it. I was specifically struck by your collection of pieces in Arlington, I believe, at the beginning of your slideshow. You said it was based on a brief layout, and you were talking about, you know, the macro and micro issues of movement. And all I could think of when I looked at that piece was it wheelchair accessible?
Yes.
It looked like there were certainly aisles that were. I didn't know if the whole
thing
was. And equally, when you were talking about, you know, being drawn to an object but being afraid of destroying it, I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user, so sometimes that feeling is amplified for me when moving around art, especially sculpture, in spaces where I don't know if accessibility has been considered, and if the width of my wheelchair will chip or dent or
just you know, that's you're the first person you know that's asked me that question, but working in a museum and being a member of the conservation department, so many of our practices of that process have really just put forth into my head, you know, like subconsciously they were there, but now it is a constant practice, and thinking that everything has to be 40 inches, you know, 40 inches, 88, it's just how I work. But also as thinking about these sculptures, and I went the route of putting everything really close together and over, you know, really filling a room. It was successful in some ways, but I appreciate the space. I appreciate that, you know, multiple people can move about them at the same time, just like ships do in a narrow channel of water. Just like you and I walk down a sidewalk and that it's wide enough and, you know, we're able to pass each other safely. But what happens when it gets really crowded? We bump into each other. So you're forced to either navigate around, over, through. So, thanks for the question. That's cool.
And I'm just glad to hear that, you know, kind of accessible design is something that you consider, whether consciously or subconsciously.
I have a question about the rules that you may set up for yourselves as you're making work. And generally speaking, I feel like art tends to be a space where one can break rules. So hearing both of you speak made me wonder if you do approach your work with rules for yourself, and if this work feels like a departure from you, for you, if there was something that you allowed to, you sort of freed yourself up to do here that you'd never done in the past.
Well, I guess what I've never done in the past in my own work is discuss my own personal stuff. I don't know. that was new. I think this one's difficult. Like, I didn't break a lot of, like, because I was basing them off board games, I felt like I had like very strict rules that I required myself to stick within. So like each one has different rules about it, but like I wanted them to be like direct references to the original games. So that created a series of rules that I couldn't break.
You learn the rules to break the rules, the old adage. But, you know, being comfortable is a rule, and there's something that kind of became a calling card, or what I was known for was what I talked about earlier, is covering the entire facade, concealing what the material was. And, you know, it's evident in some pieces and other pieces you see actually what it's made of. It's pegboard or red oak, plywood, different various materials. So, that was a conscious decision to say, pump the brakes. staying around the house. To pump the brakes and to take a step back. Kind of let the material, you know, have an honesty about it.
I have a question for Nancy.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Christian.
Hi.
A lot of the work that you, or the systems that you've described as the basis for your games, there's a, like you described with a certain amount of cynicism, which is fair, and it's just, it seems like there's a description that a lot of systems that are rigged against the player, like all the games are set up as things that are rigged against the player, which kind of alludes to some sort of like larger force or evil at work in the different like cultural segments that they represent. But looking at them, I also see that all of the sort of faceless entities that are hopeless and you can't win are based on choice as well. Like Starbucks doesn't set up, they're not pioneers, they set up in a place where they think they can sell coffee, right? And like
sure.
the gig economy, like, yeah, driving for Uber sucks, but the only reason people drive for it is because other people choose that over taxi cabs or whatever else it is that they do. I mean, academia is a mess, but it's that way because there's a population of what you might, you know, clients or students, whatever, that either don't want to pay higher tuition or that want to have, you know, an Olympic sized swimming pool in a rec center, or want to have a football team that wins championships or whatever else it is. And so I'm just wondering, like, at what point in your game do you see the player as the victim or the player as being someone that's integrated into that larger system?
I think that the player is...
I know it may be different for each game.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. So, like, with... Like, it's not so much that the player is a victim. It's... The idea is to get you to, if you are the player or if you're like watching it being played or figuring it out, is to think about how the player is working through the system. So like in Sorry Not Sorry, like, yeah, if you're choosing to adjunct, like you're choosing to be in that system. But I think that there's like a lot of people that don't understand what it's like to be in that system. And I think that there's... It's not as simple as, like, students want a, you know, a pool or, you know, like, that sort of thing. I think that a lot of it is that people don't understand how that system is working. And so I think that it's important to look at that. Like, for that one, for me personally, beyond, like, it sucking to not have health insurance or to be able to pay your bills, it also will have effects on the American education system at large. So, like, I think that in all of these, it's sort of like there's this system, the person that's playing is choosing to be in that, but it's to try to get you to see, like, it from that point of view so that it doesn't become, like, oh, well, they're choosing to be in that, or there's like this other thing that's controlling it. It's sort of like, I don't know, if you don't know, how you can't help anything. And like, you know, with like the chutes and ladders with the gig economy, I don't think that like a lot of people, like unless you're in it, like really know like how much it sucks. So like, for example, like when Uber Pool started, like, it sucks when somebody doesn't realize that they've called Uber Pool and then the driver has to pick up another person and then the person's like, ugh, you have to pick up another person? It's like, you're the jerk that called Uber Pool. Like, I'm just trying to get you to, like, think about how you, as maybe not the person that's playing it, but, like, how are you affecting that system for yourself? Not as, like, this overarching entity, but, like, just like the person that maybe uses Uber.
Sure.
Well, also looking at the board games, like, on the wall or as somebody's playing them, like, you're literally giving people a bird's eye view of these systems. Like, you're telling people to pull back and, like, look at the whole thing, but then, I mean, you can zoom in and look at the individual cards and whatever, but, like, it's also about, I think, putting them on the wall. Like, it's about this bird's eye view of, like, this closed system that's flawed.
Yeah.
And not necessarily trying to place blame on, like, the player or some, like, nameless entity either. I don't think it's about, like, blaming.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I had a question kind of expanding on what you were talking about, Shoots and Land.
Yeah.
Represent, you know, very specific experience.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that you're, you know, maybe not your the viewer that you have in mind is familiar with. So I wonder, you know, when you are creating these, do you have a certain viewer you were thinking of or viewer you were expecting?
I think that I was hoping. I think these do. Some of them more than others rely heavily on, like, you've played these games before. I think with Life and Chutes and Ladders, they're race games, so, like, you're just rolling dice and then, like, moving around a path. So I think even if you don't really understand the bigger picture of the game, you can sort of start to figure out how it works. The rest of them, they're a little bit, they are, like, if you don't have any, if you've never played any of these games before, it's a little bit more difficult, and that's part of why I wanted to also have the game nights as part of it, so that you could learn how to play them, too.
I guess I was almost wondering if there was a generational aspect, and I would hate to boil this down, you know, to an mentality, but thinking of, you know, my parents' generation would be very familiar with these board games, particularly a lot of people from their generation who are not familiar with the situations that your version of the board game are representing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think I did, I thought a lot about that, you know, the my parents' generation, like these were passed down from them, but sort of so were all of the issues that I'm discussing. So I am sort of trying, there's a little bit of that link in there that, like, they're familiar, hopefully they're familiar to people who don't necessarily understand what it's like to be starting out in these systems now.
Question, in some ways for both of you, but I'll start with Nancy about the pleasure in your work, if you could expand on how the pleasure that a player might feel in playing the game, how you understand that then to relate to the content.
Mm-hmm.
If that's in some ways supposed to be a kind of lesson, or how you understand that.
Yeah, that's sort of like where the title comes from, and, like, the reference to the myth of Sisyphus and, like, Camus' idea that, like, you have to imagine that he was happy doing this. So, like, they're not... I mean, really, with the exception of Sorry, Not Sorry, which is, like, not fun to play either. the rest of them are, like, you enjoy... you're, like, deriving joy from that system, even if ultimately it's not great. So I think it is important, except for that one, that I do see the link. I don't want you to just play them and be like with Life, for example, it's fun to play all the way through, and then you're like, oh, that was pointless. I think that's, like, very... I see a very strong parallel between that and using social media. Just like, yeah, it's fun. It's fun to take pictures of food and stuff. But then, like, what's the point? But it's still fun. So I think it is very important.
But do you see that continuing it all metaphorically to real life? It would just be the Sisyphus thing.
That's like, in real life, do I find these things to be fun?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I guess that's what I'm sort of curious about.
Yeah.
The metaphor continues.
Yeah.
How you understand.
I think it's, like, I want you to think about, like, if it's fun and why it's fun to you. So, like, for electoral risk, like, you know, before we started playing it, like, you know, it's, like, about the election, and, like, heated up and all this stuff. But then, like, as soon as you start playing, it's like, yeah, forget the middle. Like, there are no electoral... So you're, like, being put in the position of somebody who's, like, thinking about this not as there's people attached to it.
Yeah.
And, like, hopefully you're taking a good hard look at yourself.
Yeah.
In these situations and your participation in them, even if you're not the player. Yeah. Is that sort of bigger?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think for Kyle, in terms of pleasure, I was wondering, why it's important that the work withhold or lure. Why you turn the viewer into a prey?
A prey, or...
Right, in some way. Yeah, like how that's important for the content your work's generating.
You know, and maybe it's... maybe it's the personal experience of working the last 5 years at the museum and seeing how, but also being an art student and being a sculptor, it's like, how do you get their attention? Like, how do you get them to come in and look at your work, to move around it? Because for the most part, people, you know, this is more of a trend and it kind of goes on what you're talking about, Nancy. It's like they look at a museum or they look at work through their phone. And as a, you know, this is the device for seeing, not your eyes. And trying to, you know, predator and prey, you know, I mean, that's, it has a lot of strong connotations, you know, it has a lot of negative connotations. You know, maybe predator and prey is like that quick buzzword. It gets people's attention, but it's really about participatory, and, you know, engaging the viewer and activating the viewer around the space. You know, asking the viewer to take that 1.5 seconds that they naturally spend with a work in any sort of situation. Very rarely, the non-educated art community will walk into a museum, boom, 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 and be out in 30 minutes. To take that moment, become aware of where you're at, not only in let's say, my installation or arrangement of pieces, but also become aware and then take that extra time to figure out what was it. You know, if it was that shiny object that lured him in, but then, oh, or it was a color, or that looks like wood, but it's not wood. Oh, it's contact paper, you know? So there's those, that deception, but it's a device to, you know, kind of grab the 1.5 second attention span and try to slow it down to the point where, you know, you're slowing it down and allowing for the individual, encouraging the individual, inviting the individual or individuals to investigate what's what before them.
We're almost at 8:30. Amazingly, you guys did a fantastic job, and I just want to say that I really appreciate your candor with how you're thinking about your work. I think that there's a lot of really, you know, as you know, this is a fellowship program in addition to a commercial space, and so I think there's a lot of jumping off points here for your future work, and we've learned so much tonight, and I'm just grateful that you took all the risks that you did in this show. Thank you. Thank you very much.